You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps, in line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding, whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Today I'm joined by Hannah Harvey. Hannah has personal experience of an eating disorder and her own recovery journey. Hannah joins us today to discuss her hopes and plans for recovery in 2023, hoping to provide you motivation moving forward into the new year. Hello, Hannah.
Hey, Hannah.
That's so funny. Hey, Hannah. Hey, Hannah. We've got our little... We've been trying to sort out echo for about 5 minutes, so I'm glad that it's not actually echo.
True. Is this the first Han you've had on the podcast?
Is this the first Han? I've had... No, I don't think it is. I had Hannah Lewin and Hannah Lewis, and I get them both mixed up. But they go by Han, I think.
Oh, we've got a collection going.
Yeah. Yeah. You are a good person if you change it from Hannah to Han, I think. I think it's a...
This is true. That's why I did it, basically, because I'm not a good person, but you know, that was my way in.
Now you feel like you are. Yeah, definitely. I also love the fact that today is the 14th of November for everybody listening, and we are recording our New Year's episode. So if anyone would like to understand how much of an organiser I am and how forward I am in these recordings, then that is how. So, yeah. I hope you've got your New Year's hat on.
Yeah, there's fireworks about to go off.
Yeah, amazing. Oh, that's brilliant. Thank you so much for joining me, Han. I'm really excited to speak to you. I know we've been chatting quite a lot. And also, yes, by the time this is released, your blog will have been out. So that's really cool. It's not out already, is it? I'm
not
lost
yet.
In the days. No, I think it's next week.
Oh my goodness,
that it will be
exciting.
Out. So yeah. But yeah, so if you haven't read the blog, then please do read Hannah's blog, which is all about peer support that we're going to be chatting about today as well. So let's start where we always seem to start in terms of your eating disorder experience. What has that been for you?
So my eating disorder started when I was about 16. So I feel like I've basically been living in Groundhog Day for the past 12 years. Because how boring are eating disorders, right? I always feel a bit like cautious when revealing my diagnosis because I feel a collective sigh of exasperation as yet another cis white woman with anorexia is talking about their experience. But I hope that I can still add something to someone somewhere. So in these 12 years, there's not been a lot of change in terms of like my symptom presentation. But they have seen me like transition from my sixth form in Surrey to university in Sheffield, to where I now live and work, in Birmingham. And I've had quite a lot of experience in like treatment, especially in NHS services, so across those three cities. I spent most of that time, to be honest, sat on waiting lists. But I've also like had outpatient CBT, mostly in groups. I've also had like day treatment and inpatient treatment. I've never really in that time had a period where I said like, yep, I'm recovered. But what I would say is I've had some like really dark patches where I felt absolutely paralysed by it, and it's been my every waking minute. And actually I've had times where I've been able to say like, yeah, I'm living my life relatively freely. And I've been able to face things and face up to challenges. So yeah, I've had some good times, but you know, it's always kind of been there in the background.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of the reality of it, isn't it? I mean, this is literally what I was talking about in therapy just today, in terms of we were like drawing a pie chart of your life and the aspects that you have in your life, and you know, how much of that does eating sort of take up, how much do friends and family take up and stuff like that. And when I initially drew it, I did like 75% eating disorder, and then I had like three sections in the other 25%, and I split that between friends, family, and then like work/podcast. And I thought, you know what, that's not true. Because yes, I have those elements. I have my friends, I have my family, I have my work, I have my podcast, but every single part of that is tainted by the eating disorder. And you know, when I'm with friends or family, there's worries, there's concerns, there's all of that. And so actually the eating disorder is like 100%, and then those other bits like slot in kind of, yeah, wherever. Is that sort of what your experience has been when you were saying about, you know, you've been in a better, freer place, but it's almost always there?
Yeah, I would say actually I think that's really brave of you to say, because I've done that exercise and I found it really difficult to admit how much of my eating disorder takes up my life, because I've always been like, well, my family needs to take up like, I don't know, 30%, and my friends need to take up 30%. And I found it really difficult to face up to like, hey, like my relationship with my food and body and exercise take up a good 98% of this pie. And yeah, I would say that like maybe those parts of me like that really are meaningful to me, like friends and family and work and hobbies, they get bigger and the proportion of eating disorder gets smaller. But where I'm really aiming for, and where I like really think that it's possible to get to, is where the eating disorder like isn't in the pie.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you say that actually, because when I did it, I kept, so we did like, this is where I'm at now, this is where I want to get to. And I kept a slither for the eating disorder. And the therapist was like, why have you kept that? And I was like, well, you know, because there's some characteristics from it that I like I'm, you know, organized, I'm, you know, perfectionist, I'm driven and stuff like that. And they were like, well, you can have that without having an eating disorder. And that just made me realize that the eating disorder is trying to cling on so badly to be like, well, I actually give you those qualities. But I had those qualities beforehand. So it's very interesting.
Definitely. It's really confusing, isn't it? And those eating disorder, some of those thoughts are really bloody sneaky.
Yeah.
And it can convince you that, you know, you need it, you rely on it. It could be like your passport to life. Like this is why you're allowed to exist in the world, because you are these things to everyone. And it's just not true, because those people have loved you and like you and value you for the characteristics that do not involve weighing out, I don't know, bread. I don't know. I've never weighed out bread, but it was the first thing that came into my head, probably because I just ate some before we were recording. I love bread.
Yeah, I think what's also really interesting that I found when I was thinking about this was, like you've just said there, your eating disorder is not your sole purpose. You are not your eating disorder. That's not the only thing that defines you. And I put a tweet about this the other day, didn't I, and that you very kindly responded to, about saying, you know, I am a daughter, I am a sister, I am a friend, I am a podcaster, I'm, you know, all of these different things. And you very kindly said a joker, which I don't know where that came from, but thank you. And it actually, the eating sort of takes you away from all of those things. You can't be those things as much as you would like to be when you have your eating disorder. And that, I think, has been a massive shift in mindset for me that I've found quite powerful.
Yeah, it's amazing how it can really, like, feel like it takes over your identity. And I think that's one of the biggest lies that people are faced with in terms of, like, who am I going to be without my eating disorder? Like, that is who I am. That is what makes up me. And it's difficult to prize your way out of it because it does take up so much of your pie. But actually, all those parts of you are still there. It's just working out what feels really authentic. And you know, I think you never feel enough for the eating disorder, but can you feel like really comfortable in, like, well, I will never feel like I make good enough puns, but you know, you can feel that enoughness and those really authentic qualities and relationships. Like, I absolutely feel like enough to my friends and my family, and I don't feel like I need to be good enough at all the things that I love doing, like art and stuff. Like, it just doesn't matter. And that's when I know that I'm living my true Hannah-ness.
I love that. So where would you say you are currently with it all? You said that you don't think that you're recovered. I'm assuming you're in like a sort of shade of grey, which the eating disorder hates, but we love.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Embrace the grey, I always say. 50 shades of recovered.
Oh my god, that is what I'm calling this episode. That is amazing. I'm writing it down.
So yeah, so I'd say I'm doing pretty well, thanks. It's still something that I have to put effort into, and I don't know about you, but actually I find that question of how you're doing, like, can be quite difficult to provide an answer for, because it's a question that you get a lot. And I think there's various reasons for why that's hard, that involve like people pleasing and shame associated with having an eating disorder, but also maybe not feeling valid in the illness. So it's really hard to say, oh, I'm doing badly or I'm doing well. And perhaps because I've had like the illness for quite a while, I think I've become indoctrinated by the concept of thinking of recovery as a journey where you take steps forwards and backwards towards the ultimate prize of a recovered life, like it's a game of snakes and ladders or something, with like lapses and wins and going up and down. And in my experience, actually, like, mainstream treatment focuses on that very linear model of getting from point A to point B. And so all along that way, I've always got my sights set on getting to whatever that point B is, like full recovery, I suppose. So all that time, I'm always falling short. So I can end up berating myself for not being there. And then there's also that eating disorder part of me, which is glorifying where I was back at point A. So you literally can't win. And then there's times where I've been like felt a bit stuck midway, and it becomes a series of comparisons between like recovered, where I'm trying to get to, and eating disordered. And for me, I start to obsess like where I am on that scale, like where do I fall? And especially like in treatment, it's so confusing because alongside that, you've got this very tangible, visible, linear scale, which is like your weight, because that is such a big focus in treatment. And it like might slide up and down. So if you get like weighed every session and say like my weight's gone in one direction, but my thoughts and behaviours have gone in the other direction, I find that I lose my voice in being able to articulate how things are. And like I even get confused myself about what I'm aiming for and even what the reality of my situation is. So I think I don't want to just throw away that metaphor, because I love a metaphor. I'm an absolute sucker for a metaphor. So instead of a journey, I would best describe discovery. Recovery? Maybe we should call it discovery. But yeah. I'd describe recovery as a landscape. Okay, this is very hippie, but bear with.
Oh, I like it.
But because it's not somewhere that I'm trying to reach, I'm in it because you're living here now. And I think there's a danger in always trying to reach that next thing. So everyone's like landscape is a bit different and the way that we interact with it is different. But my landscape for a long time has been dominated by the absolute shitstorm of an eating disorder. And so recovery means that I acknowledge that I'm not happy with how my landscape is. And I recognize that I want to change it. And I know that with the eating disorder, I have to put effort in and I have to like set myself goals in order to change that because it's hard. And that could feel a bit weird to people who are not in the know. So people who are lucky enough not to be in the eating disorder world. So the way that I would best describe it, like that need to set goals, is to compare it to anyone's relationship with their bedroom. Okay, this is really weird, but bear with. So with our bedrooms, we all have different ideas about what makes it a nice place to inhabit. And now personally, I like my room to be tidy and I find it quite natural to do a bit of tidying every day. Now I might do a bit of cleaning at the weekends, a bit of hoovering, get the duster out, but I don't need to set myself like active goals to do that. Whereas someone who hates tidying, like they might find it really hard and they might need to make more of an effort and like set themselves tasks, and timers and rewards. And what tidy means is different to every individual. So that threshold between messy and tidy. And I think that's why we can't compare recoveries or relationships with food. So like I interact with my bedroom with very minimal effort. And when the balance tips over, I notice it becomes messy and it makes me feel uncomfortable. And I'm naturally motivated to make a concerted effort to tidy it. But my sister finds that really hard. And she may not notice how messy things have become. And so she may need a bit of a prompt for someone to like put their head around the door and say, hey, like, I can imagine you're not very happy in there with all those smelly mugs and wrappers all over the floor. Do you need some help to sort this out? Sometimes, like, I need someone to point out to me with my eating disorder recovery, like, hey, it seems like things aren't so great for you because, like, maybe I haven't noticed them slipping. Like, I haven't noticed that I'm surrounded by smelly underwear all over my floor. And so for me, like, setting goals plays a really nice role when you realise that your landscape, so your life, let's step away from this metaphor, is not comfortable. It's not where you want it to be. All that to say is, like, not that I don't believe in full recovery, like, I do, but I don't think that that has to mean where you literally don't care about the state of your bedroom. You can live happily whatever. So for me, it might mean that like my tidying is minimal effort and the mess doesn't cause me much anguish and I can be more relaxed about my threshold for what is tidy. And sometimes like I can accept that it will be a bit messy and that's okay. And that's where I think I think I might be happy if I get to that kind of relationship with exercise and my body and with eating. So you asked me like what my next steps are, and I would say that like I'm currently not very happy with my level of anxiety that I get around like say timings of meals, and I know that I avoid like brunch out, and that means that I miss out on fabulous pancakes with my friends. So the thing that I'm working on at the moment is like when I'm at home, like seeing if I can have my lunch a bit earlier, and seeing what my body does with that, like seeing like if I can trust my body's hunger cues and how I deal with that, and just building up that trust in a safe environment. Or the other thing I hate is like not knowing like what I'm going to be eating in a certain situation. So I might drop in on my parents and, you know, they might have cooked lunch or tea and, you know, I don't know what that is, but I can work on challenging that in like a safe environment and joining in with them where, you know, I feel more relaxed than trying to do that, say, at a work event where, you know, there's all kinds of dodgy sandwiches and I feel like all eyes are on me and I don't know people so well.
Yeah. I think the two metaphors that you gave were brilliant, and I really like the idea of that landscape. And I think in the same respect of you were saying, you know, sometimes your bedroom might get a little bit messy, sometimes it might be tidy, like it's not like a you know, there's not one way that your bedroom can look. I think that I like that in the landscape as well, in terms of some days are really bright sunshine with gorgeous rainbows, but that's not every day, and some days there will be clouds and it will rain and all of that, but that's life. And I think we do definitely have this perception that recovery is this beautiful garden. I mean, I've said this a thousand times, but this beautiful field of flowers and rainbows, and yeah, that's lovely and that will happen sometimes, but it's not going to be every day. And I think you're right in terms of you can start to feel like you're not doing recovery properly because not every day feels like that. And I maybe this is skepticism or pessimism, I don't know. I don't think that, well, I do think there's a fully recovered place, but I think it's that up and down like you've mentioned. And I when I had my assessment the other day, the assessor said, you're not going to get to a place where you look in the mirror and you like click your finger and go, oh my God, you look amazing. I mean, you might do some days, but like they want to get you to a place where you can look in the mirror and be like, that's my body and that's my body and that's it. I think often in recovery we think that recovered means, I don't know, it's almost, oh my God, I've just had a revelation in my brain as I was saying that. Is it that the eating disorder is making out that recovered is so brilliant and amazing and beautiful and rainbowy and florally and shiny that it feels impossible, so you just stay in the eating disorder?
Oh yeah, oh my gosh, see, it's so sneaky. It's so sneaky.
But that makes sense to me.
Yeah, it hates middle grounds. So why would recovery like why would it let your brain accept that it's a possibility because you can't get to it? So oh, it's so sneaky
because it's always just out of reach because it's that beautiful, but actually what recovered is that shade of grey, and that's totally reachable. What a revelation.
It's reachable, definitely, but it's like it's boring. That's the thing. I think when you're early in recovery, you want something that's going to be that magical because it's so hard to step out of, right? Like stepping out of any eating disorder behaviours, whatever they are, is so hard. So you need to believe that you're stepping into Disneyland on steroids, because that's got to be worth it.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Because it's so difficult. But to think that you're doing all of that hard work to get to, I'm okay with what's in the mirror. It's fine. Like, why would you do that? So I think, but that is the ultimate prize, and almost like that is more amazing. So to be able to achieve that, and like have those very mature thoughts and not get this instant gratification payoff, like of the flowers and the fields, like that is incredible, and that is so strong. And I think because you get such instant gratification from the eating disorder, like that's really difficult to pull away from.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Do you get...
You can.
What, on a podcast, can I ask you? Do you get gratification?
Not anymore, no. I remember it. I remember it so well. Yeah, the early days, oh my goodness, it was such a buzz. I guess it's like if you have an absolutely, I don't know, maybe I was going to say it's like if you take it back to your cake and like the first like slice of that, like, or bite of that cake might be amazing, and then you start to habituate to it. Mm-hmm. But maybe it's like with Disneyland, like the first day in Disneyland, it's absolutely amazing. You go on the rides for the first time, you're like, oh my goodness, that's amazing. But I bet if you rode, I don't know what rides are in Disneyland, but I bet if you rode some of those
Rocky
rides.
Rocky Mountain. It's Small World.
Oh, see, I bet if you rode It's a Small World every day for the next year, like it wouldn't have that same excitement and magic.
No.
Whereas to begin with, you get such wins from it, and you're always chasing that and chasing it and chasing it. And I think I've been very careful not to make that comparison with like drug addiction, because I've never experienced drug addiction, and I think people are very quick to do that. And I also can't stand the thing of, oh, it's easier to recover from like drug or alcohol addictions because you don't need them in your life, but you need food. Because I think like that's such an unnecessary comparison. We're all struggling, and we're all struggling together. But I think there is that similarity in terms of you do habituate to it, but you're always chasing that initial high because you weren't getting it for anything else in your life, and at that time you needed it. Otherwise, why would you turn to such a destructive behavior? I mean, they're all behaviors. I can't think of a single behavior in an eating disorder that is a nourishing, like kind behavior to your body.
No.
So there must be a reason that we were chasing it.
Mm. I guess that's it, isn't it? Like that chasing the dragon or whatever they call it, of like you're initially when you do it, you get that buzz, and then the next time you do it, you don't. It has to be a bit more. Or like what I found recently is that like I will have, a handful of rules that I follow, but then they're not enough. So then the eating sort of provides another rule and another rule and another rule, and then it becomes like a mountain of rules that you're like, well, it took me, you know, what, one time to do it, and now that's stuck in my life and I can't stop it. Like it's so quick to happen, but to take it back is so difficult to break out of it. But then they just keep on building, because like you said, you habituate towards it, and then you've got that, you know, ritualistic aspect of it, and that feels unbreakable because of the discomfort that the eating sort of provides when you do try and break out of it.
Absolutely. And I think there's that false belief that a little bit more, if I give a little bit more of myself, if I sacrifice a little bit more, I can get to something that's worthwhile. And I think naturally, like, a lot of us have, like, personalities like that in, like, other areas of life as well. And I think actually, like, stepping in the opposite direction, going against the current, is really, really difficult. And that's the thing that you've got to do to get out. But I think eventually, if you take enough steps away, like, you can almost forget how deep and how important those rules were, and they sort of fade away, and then you start to, like, forget, like, what was my rule that I had when I was 23?
Yeah.
How many of that thing did I have to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you started to, I mean, I'm assuming that you've broken away from some rules because of what you've just said, but how did you even navigate that? Was it like karate chop off, or was it tentatively, you know, peeling back the layers a bit?
Oh, it depends. I mean, sometimes within peeling back the layers, it feels like I'm karate chopping off.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a difficult one. I think it's always that initial push can be really difficult, and sometimes it just depends what kind of day you're having. I think it can depend whether you go, like, gently, whether that's the best approach, or you just need to go full force into it. I think everyone's different, and you just kind of experiment and see what's a good fit for you at that time. And anything that gets you going in that direction, you know, go for it. And it may be that your big karate chop, like, is one in a series.
I guess with that in mind, sort of thinking about the new year as well,
mm-hmm.
when, you know, you mentioned that goals had been something that was quite important to you and that you like to set, and it might be the same answer as what the question I just asked, but for you, is it kind of setting big goals more important or small goals? Because I find in myself that to say to myself, I want to recover to be able to be pregnant, or things that are so far in the distance for me, it's too much to kind of comprehend when I'm in the moment of, like, you know, making lunch or something. Like, I can just skimp on it here because it's not going to affect me in the long term. But for me, having smaller goals, like, I don't know, adding a snack in at a certain time each day, which is something that I will have to keep on doing, and feel smaller, that for me works better. But I'm interested to see if that's the same for you, or kind of you've got a mix or whatever.
So I think you kind of do need to have both big and small goals at the same time. And I think exactly, like, what feels like a big goal at one stage might change. So, like, I remember how impossible it felt at one time to eat a slice of toast. And that is mind-boggling to me that that was ever hard now. Like, as I say, I was munching away on bread before the podcast. But something I've actually done quite recently is write down all of my sparkly life goals. So there are my big goals, like, I want to eat donuts on the beach, and I want to go out for brunch with my friends on my birthday, and I, one day, really like to have afternoon tea at the Ritz. Ooh. But I want, wouldn't that be amazing? Yeah. Absolutely. But I want those experiences to be, like, in the moment, free of anxiety. Because, like, right now, I could go to a party and I could eat a piece of cake, like, that's something that I can do, but the compensation around that, the fear in that moment, and the guilt afterwards is so not what I was ever aiming for. But I can't get those big outcomes, like the meaningful ones with true happiness, without doing those little actions. And so in come my small foodie goals. So That's why I've got also this list of my boring goals, which will get me to my sparkly goals. So that might just be, like you say, a snack that I find hard. And I have to do it at home on my own. And there is no one there to celebrate and no one watching me do it apart from me and my very rude eating disorder. And those goals can feel materialistic and they can feel small, but they are really important. And also, without the big goals, small goals, like they do start to lose meaning. I mean, I used to question, when faced with the fear food, like, how the heck is this one sandwich going to change anything? So, because it's, like I said, like, so hard, like, you know, it's so hard to face your fears. Why would you leave the comfort of the eating disorder for a, like, for a Tesco meal deal sandwich? Well,
personally, well, bloody love a Tesco meal deal, but, you know, whatever floats your boat.
I mean, you know, all right, you know, one of the wraps, they're not great, are they?
No, that's true, no. And to be fair, if it was between Tesco or Boots, I'd be going for Boots every time.
Exactly. And the thing is, like, one day the sandwich is going to be one that, like, my grandma's lovingly made for me, or it's going to be a finger sandwich at the Ritz. And you can be fully present in those moments because you've conquered that fear at home. Or maybe there will never be a sparkly sandwich moment in your life, but you'll have a better functioning brain that's less distracted by the thoughts of food and body and destructive urges, and you can be more present and calm in your life. And that is why, Han, one boring Tesco meal deal wrap is going to change your life. And I never used to understand that.
I think what I have realised, and I think I probably said a million times in this podcast as well, is that it's not about getting to the Ritz sandwich and tasting the Ritz sandwich. It's about going to the Ritz with whoever you're going with and the sandwich is coming over and not thinking, how many calories is in the sandwich? How can I get away with not having very much? How can I do this? How can I do that? It's just chatting and being like, oh, look, the food's arrived. How lovely. And nibbling away whilst you're chatting and having pictures taken and not thinking, oh, shit, I need to see that picture really quickly to make sure I look okay. But looking at it later and thinking, what an amazing day I have had. And I think that is, to me, why maybe it's so difficult for me to think about the food as getting me there, because my goals for recovery, or how I see recovery, is not food orientated, but right now the food is affecting everything. So I think, like you said, you know, that shitty Tesco wrap that actually I'm not a massive fan of, but it's terrifying to do because I've not made it, or the amount of calories in it, or whatever, that is the sort of, you know, one of a million keys to unlock the connection at the Ritz.
Exactly. It's going to change your brain.
Yeah.
It's brain food. And it will do. And you know, if I transplanted you to the Ritz right now with all of your favourite people, or me, then I just know that my brain is not going to be there. And that's why it's going to be worth it. It's playing the long game. And that is hard, because the eating disorder is all about the short term. It's always about what's going on in that moment. And that's where that amazing quote comes in. I always hear it on Megzi's videos, where she's like, don't give up what you want the most. No, don't give up what you want the most for what you want in the moment. And I think that absolutely nails it.
Yeah. It's almost like that really horrific phrase in diet culture about lips and hips. But if we twist it, then, you know, I'm trying to think how we can twist it to make it positive towards recovery rather than pink.
A moment on the lips and your eating disorder unzips. Your true self is revealed.
Oh my god, I love it.
Like stepping out into your new life.
Sparkly self unzips.
Oh, I love it.
Wow.
This is very much the Ritz, isn't it?
It is very much the Ritz, yeah. I love that a lot. So, where are we? That's just really excited me, so I felt a bit lost. So, in terms of goals, we want big and small, which I think is, you know, makes a lot of sense because then you have something for your small goals to add up to. So how do you use your peer support group to be able to sort of explore those goals and work towards that kind of ritzy, sparkly moment?
Oh, yeah, that's a really good one. So actually the goal setting with the peer support group was like such a chance encounter.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an idea that didn't come from my recovery. It was when I was writing my PhD with my friend in lockdown. It was an absolute daily slog. So she was writing hers as well. We weren't writing it together. But every day what we do is we'd WhatsApp each other with like a tiny goal to achieve that day. And there was absolutely like no pressure to do it or to report back even. But just the idea of accountability was so good to keep it in my mind and make me want to do it. And at the time, let me tell you, I really did not want to write my thesis. I hated it nearly as much as I hated eating a meal plan. So that tells you how much I hated it. So when I was setting up the support group, I thought, I wonder if at the end of each session, if I just invite people to set themselves like a recovery orientated goal, like it can be anything that's meaningful to them. And then they can let us know how they got on like next month, and absolutely no pressure. Like no one has to set a goal. No one has to report back. But there's such a community in knowing that others are taking on something that challenges them as much as it challenges you. And honestly, I think it's one of the best ideas that my little brain has ever come up with. And to hear people willing to challenge themselves and then they surprise themselves with the outcome, honestly, it's one of the most incredible life-affirming experiences. And that is cheesy, but it's so true.
Yeah.
So I think done in the right way, goal setting can be super helpful. But, you know, like, of course, many of us associate it, especially around New Year, like, oh, it's so synonymous with weight loss targets, like step counts and unrealistic achievements. And yeah, people in the group can find New Year like really hard, actually. I think it's really useful to like reframe what goal setting can be.
I suppose in that sort of notion, I mean, I've never been a fan of like New Year, New Me, which is why I think I don't really get affected by the New Year drastically, because I feel like when people go on a diet around New Year or pick up a new exercise regime, I was like, like every year, and so in a couple of weeks it'll be over. But I think that's because I just know that, you know, people don't stick at things when they make drastic changes. Most people probably, eating disorder kind of is a bit different, really, isn't it? But standard Joe.
Well, yeah, I think with that you get so sucked in that your original goal gets so lost, and well, you know, yeah, you just tumble down a well.
Yeah. But how would you kind of, would your advice be to people that are really struggling? Because ultimately recovery does tend to be the complete opposite to what society tells us to do in terms of weight loss and food restriction and stuff like, you know, changing any of those behaviours. So in terms of if people are trying to recover, but they've got 1,001 people around them telling them that they've picked up this new diet, this new exercise regime, how, like, what do you do in that situation to keep yourself motivated and focused on your goals?
To keep myself motivated on my goals, there's a couple of ways. I think writing everything down that you want to achieve and working through them can be quite helpful. You could like categorize them, so that might be what feels easy and hard, kind of like a traffic light system. When I was first in treatment in 2012, it's something that they encouraged me to do, and actually, like, it was quite a fun part of the process. Or, like, might not be easy and hard, but maybe it's like from important to less important. So you might say prioritize eating like 3 meals and 3 snacks a day over having like a particularly fancy Starbucks drink, for example. And another way that I've seen people do it is write them down, cut them up and stick it in a jam jar and pull them out at random, which adds a lovely element of spontaneity, which eating disorders often steal from us, don't they? So I think like adding an element of fun can be helpful. But what I often do more these days is like a look at what's coming up this week and or this month, and I'll set a relevant goal. So it might be that I'm going on a breakfast date with my friend in the city, and I know that I always order a safe option. So my goal might be to have something a little bit more out there, or it might be just to get the same as whatever she's having. So, you know, I've got no control over it. Or some weeks it's just for me to go and not cancel. So that for me is another way that I'm able to stick to my goals. So to keep them moving and to just check in with myself and work out what I need. So it's not really about the goal. It's about me and what I'm trying to achieve and what I feel I'm capable of. Yeah. And I think with sticking to your goals, it's not uncommon to have moments where recovery feels really uncomfortable. You might have like thoughts of running back to your eating disorder, and the idea of going against it can feel really overwhelming. And I have moments where, you know, I get really, really frustrated with myself, and, you know, it feels really selfish, and it feels like, you know, gosh, there's bigger issues in the world than me, you know, eating a flipping Bakewell tart. You know, we're in an environmental crisis. Why are you putting so much energy into this? But these are all kind of distractions, really. And, you know, you can't give your whole self to, I don't know, whatever's meaningful to you, like saving the planet, if you can't give to yourself. I think in terms of sticking to your goals, it's just like being aware of these thoughts that sneak up on you and really keep in mind what's meaningful to you. Mm-hmm. And whatever you envision for your future, you know, no matter what anyone else is doing with their new year, I'll take a bet that like your future likely doesn't involve being unkind to yourself. Including with food and the way you speak to yourself, and the way you treat your body. So you might look at what you want to get out of recovery. And they might be, you know, being present with your friends and wanting to avoid the long-term consequences like impaired bone health. And I want lovely, beautiful, strong hair. I want to be someone who has enough self-respect that they can treat themselves kindly. I don't think that when I've got an eating disorder, any of my behaviours, like, align with that vision for myself.
I think you're so right. And I think what you were saying there about almost, it's not always about the goal, but about how you are as well. And, you know, I think you can always be making progress, even if it's small progress. So if one day is a really horrible day and you'd set it in your sights to do something massive, maybe today's not the day, but rather than not doing anything, still do something little. It's that kind of shade of grey, I guess, that we're always trying to get to. So thank you so much. I think this has been amazing. And I think everybody will get so many tips from this. What I want to do before we finish, because we've got like a month and a half until this is going to be released, I think we should both set ourselves a goal for when this is released. And then when it's released, we'll see, did we achieve that goal or not?
I love that. Yeah, okay. That's a great idea.
Okay, you go first because I haven't thought of one yet.
Oh, I love this. So I actually have two big ones for this year.
Mm-hmm.
Can I have two? Is that really cheeky?
You can have 50.
Well, you don't want me reading out 50 on the podcast. Like, everyone's going to tune out by the time I get to number 5. Okay, so my first one is that I want to be louder in calling out diet culture, because actually I've got the body privilege to do that. So, for example, there are loads of weight loss ads at work, like on the walls in the staff kitchen. So I put up flyers for Beat next to them.
Nice.
Like, it's easier for me to speak out and challenge those conversations because I live in a straight size body. And I need to do that as an ally to those in marginalized bodies. Oh, so disappointed by the lack of support for fat people when Taylor Swift released that video for Anti-Hero, and fat people told us it was hurtful. Rather than stand with them, a lot of straight-sized people ran to the defense of a music video. And like, not 2 weeks later, we were devastated by the article saying that heroin chic was in. And I did not see any fat creators shooting down straight-sized people with a history of eating disorders for finding it offensive. So that, for me, has solidified the active role that I need to take in calling out diet culture. And my second one is to be really aware of the subtle messaging around New Year. So, for me, and I think you alluded to this earlier, it's quite easy to see the big red flags of like weight loss ads, and tough though they are, I'm pretty attuned to them. So I can ignore them or challenge them. And it's the more subtle things, like, so when I'm listening to someone speak and they'll say something like, oh, if you eat donuts for breakfast, you might feel amazing and it might be really fun. And then by 11 a.m. or after a week of doing it or something, you start to feel really sluggish. And I'll nod along being like, yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah. But I've never tried it. I don't know. Really? Do I know that? What if, like, eating donuts for breakfast, like, makes me feel at my best every day? And it's like opening my eyes and not just nodding along to everything I hear in the name of wellness. Like, those are my two goals, and I think both are really important.
Nice. Yeah, I very much like them. Very good goals. I got so encapsulated in you talking that I didn't start thinking for myself. I've got one actually. My goal is by the end of the year to be actively engaging in eating disorder treatment.
Ooh, what does actively mean for you?
So I think that's a really good point actually, because it's quite vague. Actively
vague is okay.
No, I think it needs to be more specific, because otherwise you don't know whether you've achieved it. Because right now I am doing like a group therapy thing, but that's not eating disorder specific. And I think actively engaging to me means when they set me some homework, actually doing it. Actually doing like my one last week, I've not even thought about. So I just know at the moment I'm not
this is not who I thought you were. You're a rebel.
I am perfect.
I thought you'd be turning in that homework.
Recovery. Yeah, no, I'm not that everybody else should be doing this, but I guess a bit of realism is that, yeah, no, I not always is around the door, and I am a bit of a rebel. But I would like to be actively wanting to participate rather than turning up every week and saying, nah, didn't do that. That'd be good.
Do you know what? That honesty is so refreshing. And I think that's really important. And I think that's one of the things around New Year. Like, we wait for New Year, don't we? To be like this convenient reason to change.
Yeah.
And I think, like, you can get that fresh feeling of a new year anytime you want.
Yeah.
Like, hey, new day, new afternoon, new number of minutes past 3 on a Wednesday. Yeah. Let's go.
I think people so heavily rely on New Year and it just doesn't work. No. You, like, my mum, when I was younger, would always be like, oh, like, I don't know, she'd start a new diet and then she'd have a chocolate bar on a Wednesday and she's like, oh, well, the week's falling apart now, so I'll have to start next Monday. And it's like, not that I'm promoting dieting here, but with anything, like, just because you have not aligned with what your overall goal was doesn't mean that you have to wait until something else. So, like, let's say you want to start wearing more clothes in your wardrobe because you only wear like a particular few, or you want to start drawing every day, do it today, do it right now, don't wait until New Year, because then there's so much of that time leading up to it that it's not gonna happen.
Absolutely, you can get that feeling whenever you want.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's all about that commitment to yourself, and that's why I hate that phrase New Year, new me. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, is it you that you're changing, or actually are you drawing on aspects of yourself to cultivate things in your life that are really meaningful? You know, you can always do things differently, but head towards yourself, not away from yourself.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much, Han. It has been an absolute pleasure. And weird to say this, but Happy New Year.
Ah, Happy New Year. Happy Christmas and happy birthday and happy Easter.
Well, my birthday is actually 20th January, so you're not that far away.
What? When?
28th of January.
No, that is my birthday.
You're lying.
No, I'm not. I promise. 28th of January, 1994.
7. Holy shit!
That's so weird. Double H's. Double.
Oh my god, Hannah Hicken both them. And Hannah, what's your middle name?
Olivia.
Alice.
Oh,
that's quite similar though.
That's very similar.
It's a vowel.
You know what? I feel like I've revealed enough information about myself that, you know, people can steal my identity.
What's postcode? What's your national insurance?
What's your bank details?
Oh wow, that is. I can't wait to go back and look at the picture, like get a screenshot of when we just realised we had the same birthday, because that's going to be.
I know this podcast, but so people can't see, but our face, like, yeah. Our jaws dropped.
Oh my god! Wow. Peace. We best have cake.
Well, thanks
then.
For having me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. We are going to have a double cake. Absolutely.
Sparkly one.
Definitely. Yeah. Sparkly girls cake. So you've got to eat loads of boring cake until then.
Yeah. Cake you don't like. Cake that's not that good. All of it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Amazing. Well, I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.